which is too bad. So let me just start here, and then we're going to come back to the action. I promise I was going to go there, but let's just put a little bit into perspective where some of the conclusions we derived. So in particular, we said, well, in the weak field scenario, we can work through our Einstein's equations and the analogy with particles moving in the gravitational field. We wrote this, and let's just kind of estimate what is the gravitational potential on Earth in reasonable units, i.e. in no units. So we just, we're going to use C is equal to 1, G is equal to 1. H bar is no longer, it's not in the mixture, though we're going to discuss about it in just a second. So let's take, so we know the gravitational potential of at the surface of Earth is, say, is m over r. Again, in these units, that's all there is. So let's just compute what this ratio would be. OK, so a very convenient unit of, or kind of unit of measure is this solar mass. In even in special relativity, we know, I mean, there is only one scale, either length or time, and we can go from one into the other one. So we're going to just pick the mass will be length, time, and because it's mass, mass is also energy, so everything will be in units of m solar. So the mass of Earth, so this mass of Earth, radius of Earth, is, I'm going to start putting in terms of units, solar mass units, is about 3 × 10⁻⁶ times the mass of the sun. The radius is roughly 10⁻², the mass of the sun. Sorry, 10⁻², the radius of the sun. And then the radius of the sun in these units, we're going to keep going to the solar mass unit. This is about 10⁵ solar masses. So just as to give you an example, the solar mass is solar mass. The radius, in terms of a unit of radius, the solar mass is about 1.5 kilometers. And we're going to get to that later when we discuss black holes, how that number comes naturally. So if you put everything together, then you find out that for Earth, pi of Earth, at the surface of Earth, it's about 10⁻⁹. Remember, we're comparing this number to 1. We said, oh, this number has to be much smaller than that one because we're in the weak gravitational regime. So it's 9th order of magnitude hidden below 1. So we were pretty happy with that. And if you do the same calculations for the sun, this is about 10⁻⁶. So again, you're safely doing that. But going back to one of the questions that were asked the other day, of course, this is local in time. If you build, if you wait long enough, these small errors will accumulate. And secular effects will show clear departures. So in particular, the GPS has that. If you initially, the story goes that engineers did not believe people in physics, and they said, OK, we're going to put a switch there to allow gravitational corrections to be accounted for or not. And initially, they were not accounted for them. And within 3 hours, they were just too inaccurate. The GPS were not useful anymore. But then you turn on the switch. I'm not sure if that story is true, but of course, it goes back to a joke between engineers and physicists. The R thing we know is when once we write Einstein's equations, there is no intrinsic scale. There is nothing there like the mass of the electron that would tell us there is something special. The gravitational field for an object of mass m, if it is the sun, mass of the sun, the mass of the Earth, or for mass of whatever you want, divided by its radius or whatever at the surface, will be the mass divided by its radius. And it might change if the radius and the mass scale the same way, you're going to always get the same number, regardless of how large or how heavy an object is, how much mass it might have. But OK, intrinsically, we know that there is also Heisenberg's principle, uncertainty principle that we haven't discussed. So there has to be a limit where the classical description should fail. So one at least easy estimate of when things could fail is to think of even the basic constants of nature that we can identify, or constants of physics that we can identify. You can make combinations and define things like, oh, where do I have this? In particular, what's called the Planck length. You might have seen this already. And this is the constant of length that you can make up by using, say, h bar, g, and c, with the appropriate powers so that they make up a unit of length. And if you put this, this is equal to roughly 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. So at least at those scales and below, we would expect that our theory that is classical at this moment, because we have no h bar anywhere, should fail. Similarly, you can then put together, and this is kind of called the Planck energy. This is the Planck length. The Planck energy would be h bar c to the 5 over g 1/2. This is roughly 10 to the 19 giga electron volts. Again, so if you get to that high energies or higher, you would expect our description to not be valid anymore. Something will happen. But so we're going to have to keep that in mind. And of course, as we said the other day, a lot of the, bless you, of efforts nowadays in quantum gravity is try to kind of reconcile quantum principles with class, with the way we are understanding gravitational interactions. And OK, there is nothing solid at this moment, though some of my colleagues might not like what I just said. So at the classical level, we're going to allow ourselves to go to any scale, any amount of time, whatever, provided the theory doesn't break down. So what does it mean but for a theory to break down? It will mean the curvature blowing up. So that's a singularity. Of course, as you know, a singularity is just a code name or a code word to say, we don't know what to do there. Something went wrong. And we're going to have to find a way to replace it. But we still haven't found it. So the issue, one would be tempted to say, well, maybe this is every time the metric becomes degenerate. Either its determinant is infinity or zero. We cannot find, say, even the metric. There is no way to define this inverse. But if that need not be the case, we might have chosen bad coordinates. If we choose bad coordinates, we might have a metric that becomes degenerate just because of our choice of coordinates. And an example would be, again, this one. So suppose we're in two dimensions, and we just choose spherical coordinates. Well, at theta equals zero, this metric is becoming degenerate. This goes to zero. The determinant is zero. So what happened here? Well, what happened is we just chose bad coordinates. Because if we go to Cartesian coordinates, there's nothing wrong there, right? So we're going to have to find what are the right tools to analyze even this potential problem, where it was our fault or the consequence of a bad choice of coordinates, or truly a problem on the of the theory breaking down. Yes.
So I've always heard this about how, like, we can have coordinate singularities, and it's like, and then we have to find a new coordinate system and whatnot. But what I would really love to see, I don't know if you have any examples, is like thinking about a coordinate system that's not just written by the metric, but like our nice Cartesian XYZ. Is there a way to rewrite like a more simple coordinate system, like in the way of just saying, you know, we have, you know, our XYZ things, and kind of see how we could get something that gives us a coordinate singularity?
Yes. So we discuss one example. So take this the surface of Earth and use our standard latitudes and longitudes, we know, so this point here is the extent of that point here is zero, whatever, zero latitude, and we may have whatever, 10 degrees east, 10 degrees west. These are distinct points. But now follow it to the north, and now those two points became the same one. So here we are stuck because remember our, if you want, our machinery that we introduced to distinguish points by going to the appropriate chart. So here, where do we go? We have a label that says 10 west, 10 east for this one, 10 west for that one, and now there's a single point. So that's a coordinate singularity.
But is it really like this singularity? I mean, you get like the same, it gets to the same point, but why does that mean anything blows up?
Okay, it doesn't, but you're using intuition that you know that point. There's nothing wrong with that point. But suppose I didn't show you this, and I'm telling you, oh, there are two points that are labeled this way, and at some point they are telling you this point is labeled this way, this point is labeled also in a different way. So that's going to be manifested in the metric you've written, and it's very much this issue here.
Is it really?
Yeah, so a piece of your metric is going to zero. If you compute the determinant, it's zero. There is no inverse, and now you can't do, you don't have the tools to keep going.
Oh, okay.
So we're going to introduce.
Where does the claim that determinant is coordinate independent come into this picture?
The determinant is coordinate independent?
Yeah.
What's the determinant of this?
Yeah, so that claim is wrong.
Yeah.
Is it?
I think what you.
Determinant of
what you're remembering. Wait. A scalar, okay, good point. It's often said that scalars are coordinate independent, but careful because hidden in them, there is an evaluation at points, right? So determinant, so take a scalar, construct it in any way you want, it will depend on your coordinates, right? But it might be that these coordinates just became completely defined, you cannot evaluate them. So at face value, so the scalar transform as a scalar, so it doesn't pick a Jacobian. But its arguments do know what particular coordinate system you're using. And if they became ill-defined, then your scalar cannot be evaluated, or it blows up. And so we have to be careful on that. But sorry, let me take back what I just said. If the coordinates become ill-defined, we're in trouble. But if the coordinates are well-defined at a point, and yet things are blowing up, then that's going to be telling us, oh, that's a true singularity. And once we write like this, the solution or the standard spherical, the simplest spherical black hole we can think of, which is Schwarzschild, we're going to see that we have two places where the metric will be degenerate or will have issues. That will be at the horizon and at the origin. And then when we compute scalars, we're going to see there is nothing wrong at the horizon, but it still blows up at the origin. And that's what we're going to tell. Oh, one is a true singularity, the other one is not.
Okay, so is this claim true then? Any scalar and, what we're talking about scalars in any well-defined coordinate system,
should have the same values. Yes. Then the tricky thing is will be that the coordinates are well-defined and you can be sure that it's the same point. But if that's true, then you're good. So I'm going back and forth because I want to show you a few things. Let's see. I think this is all I want to say here.
Sorry.
Yes.
So in general, you plug into Einstein's equations the stress tensor and you find the metric, and it might have singularities that are either coordinate singularities or actual singularities. Is it always enough to compute a scalar observable with well-defined coordinates to identify all singularities?
Your question, yeah, that's a very good question. And the answer is, if you can think of all possible scalars and any of those, you could have n, imagine you write n scalars. N minus one are perfectly well-defined and one blows up, yeah, that's a singularity.
So it's not enough to compute all one scalar.
might not be enough to compute it for one scalar. So you might have scalars. So let me just give you a very simple example. Again, let's take Schwarzschild, which you have not yet seen, but we're going to see the Schwarzschild is a solution to Einstein equations in vacuum, as I said the other day, so RAB is zero. One scalar we can construct out of it is the Ricci scalar. The Ricci scalar will be zero. So this scalar is perfectly well defined. And we might have another one, which we're going to give it a name later on, called the Kretschmann scalar. This one will be non-zero. And okay, just since I'm getting ahead of myself, this will be the mass to some power divided by the radius to some other power, which is higher than that. And if we evaluate it at r equals zero, this one blows up, and it's a well-defined point. Even though the metric is blowing up both at r equals zero and r equals r minus 2m. So at r minus 2m, we will have seemingly a problem in the metric. But the scatter says nothing. This scatter says nothing. But you have to have sufficient number of scatters that test things before you say you have some confidence that there is not a singularity.
So for example, if the scalar value is zero anyways at that point, then it wouldn't be able to tell you anything about the...
Well, you'd be tempted to say, oh, this is fine, because we could be doing, we compare it with flat space-time. This also gives you zero in flat space-time. So that this one will give you zero, that will be, well, this one will give you zero. Okay, in flat space-time, there are no singularities. But then you would add, you say, okay, two, is there another one? And after evaluating enough, you're going to kind of be start feeling good about yourself, that you have explored well the range of possibilities. But it still is a little bit of an art. You have to get have some sort of intuition of what is the right tools. Usually, this in and of itself is pretty good because we know, okay, let me just connect with something I'll say later. This one knows about all components of the Riemann tensor. And this is the Riemann tensor was our kind of tool that we constructed everything about trying to explore the curvature of the space-time or the curvature of our manifold. This one we know we constructed out of it, this one, by throwing away all the things that were trace-free. So there is some piece of information that this one has still that we threw it away here. This is insensitive to that. So maybe the trace parts are good, but the trace-free parts are the ones where the problems reside.
The Riemann scalar is a scalar, but the second, the Ricci scalar is a scalar, but the second scalar you've written, is that a scalar? Or
this one?
Or is it a scalar density?
Yes, so no, it's a scalar. We haven't talked about scalar densities. We're going to put, it's a scalar because every single index here is contracted when one index over there. Of course, we can also construct this one. Okay, I have to be careful here because I don't want to mess up with the indices. So let me put it this way. So I could have said, oh, I'm going to construct this one. But this one, we all know what the answer would be. What would be the answer of this scalar?
Zero
carries by symmetry. So then I don't do that. That's a bad idea. They can do this. That would be an R scalar. For Schwarzschild, or for a vacuum solution, this will be zero because these ones will be zero. But that's an R scalar that we can construct. And so on and so forth. We could also do, I don't know, just for the sake of the argument. B, right? That's an R one. Here we're testing something that now knows about higher derivatives of our curvature, our main curvature, or one of our main curvature tensors. And again, you do sufficient number of these to satisfy yourself that you have explored enough. So let's do a warm up before I discuss the action. So going back to also some questions yesterday, suppose that we know that for some or for many fields, depending on what type of physics we're coupling or we're considering, we're going to have a stress energy tensor associated to that. But we also know out of these, say, the equations of motion would be for that description will be hidden or be contained in this, the divergence of that stress energy tensor to be zero. But we also know the equations of motion come from an action principle. Let's say the action principle with respect to some variables, which are the variables that describe the interactions of that physics that you're considering. And by doing suitable variations of this, or I, by going through the Euler-Lagrange equations, you obtain what the equations of motions are. So let's give one example, but this is just a warm up for what we want to do next, which is to derive Einstein's equations from an action principle. So what I'm doing is not the straightest way of obtaining equations of motion for the model I'm going to discuss, but it's the one that is mimics most what we're going to do then with Einstein's equations. So consider the following. Oops. So this is what we're going to ask to define what is the action principle associated with a scalar field that has a potential. So this is just
wait, sorry, is there a prime?
No, it's
okay.
The end of the square root. Okay, so let's imagine we start with an action. And we're trying to find what the equation of motions are associated with that. And the way we're going to proceed is to vary with respect to phi. So we're imagining we're kind of holding our initial and end states of the scalar field. And then we vary and say, what does that imply to max extremizing this action? So we do consider the variation. But now we're varying with respect to phi. Oops, phi. Phi, psi. Where is the person that knows? She's in the back.
It's phi.
OK. And this one?
Psi.
And this one?
Phi. That's also
phi. OK, I don't know. I mean, then yeah, I don't know. To me, these three are the same, so sorry. I don't know. Some people are colorblind. I have this problem. So if I vary with phi, I will pick a variation here. Let's imagine, for the sake of the argument, for simplicity, that we have no potential. I will pick a variation here. I will pick another variation there. So this will give us now minus dAb. I have two, one here and one the other one there. Yeah, I say phi, dB, delta phi.
Okay, sorry, what happened to the measure?
This one is still here. Okay. I'm not varying over that, so it is whatever. Then we do iteration by parts. So we take at least d, put it out, and we're imagining that the metric stays fixed.
Phi is decoupled from the metric?
No, no. The metric, we're assuming the metric is constant in this case. And so then I just use iteration by parts. This is the same as this class. Now, so we iterated by parts. We're keeping the end states fixed. So this is a total derivative. We can ignore it. And then the rest is this one.
Wasn't delta phi also in the derivative the first term?
Yes, sorry. Thank you. So this term we can ignore. And this is the one that gives us our equation of motion, because the variation has to be 0 for any change that any small change that we can consider for the scalar field. So then out of this one, we conclude that the equation of motion that we want the field to satisfy is this one, which is just the box of phi equals 0. All right, that's the equation of motion for our free scalar field.
Yes. I heard that sometimes that people, they put the covariant derivatives just because the second derivative is not.
Yeah. But I mean, like here, okay. I'll do that, but this is just a warm-up.
Okay.
Yeah. I should have put here, Okay, that comment was careful when I took this, I have a vector in here, so I might as well start. It's better to start with the covariant derivatives to begin with, and so then this is true. Thank you for that.
Where did the TAB come from again?
The TAB? Oh.
The DA phi, DB phi that you just
read. So then we're going to come in here and obtain the TAB. So what did we do here? Here we vary with respect to phi. When we vary with respect to G, we're going to get the TAB. So hold on that thought. We're going to get there. We're going to come back to this expression in a tensor. And then we're going to get the TAB. But first, let's get answers to the question.
Wait, sorry, why is that a derivative with respect to A instead of a covariant derivative with respect to A?
So, good.
Very last step, very, very last.
Good. Because in the end, I mean, based on that comment, I was being very quick in my analysis, but better be careful. So I changed all the derivatives to covariant derivatives. When we act on scalars or functions, we know the derivative, the covariant derivative, and the partial derivative are the same. That was our consistent constitution. If I carry with covariance, I don't have to worry about correcting terms or anything. So let's do the same, but now for Einstein's equation. And again, how do we get here? Well, you start, or Hilbert started saying, okay, I know where I should get as far as the equation's motion. So there has to be an action principle associated with my main variable, which is the metric. I want to have something that at most have second derivatives at the end of the day, because we know Newtonian gravity had second derivatives for gravitational potential. So what should be the right thing to put inside the action to obtain the equations? So we start with, or let's go and derive from the right ansatz. So we have the volume element. Here we're going to stick just as the Ricci scatter. The reason I said let's go with the varying explicitly the field over there was also here. Remember, if we wanted to use the Euler-Lagrange equations, so in the Euler-Lagrange equations, you take the derivative with respect to the derivative for your functional or your Lagrangian density with respect to the first derivative of your field. But the derivative of our field, well, the derivative we know is a covariant, and our field is the metric. So the covariant derivative of the metric will give us zero, so we're going to get stuck. So we can't go that way. So let's just bite the bullet and consider small variations in the metric. Here I'm being sloppy, I'm not putting subindices. This is just to make it understood that this is what we're going to be doing, just replacing the G by G plus delta G, and then going through. And we're going to have three contributions. Let me just make this explicitly. So we're going to have a contribution coming from here. When we vary the metric, this one will get varied. And so we're going to pick up delta G out of this term. Of course, we're going to get an obvious one here. And then we're going to get another one here. So I promise this is trivial, this is a mess.
Wait, sorry, you might have already said this. But how come in this case we're varying the metric, but in the last case we didn't have?
Good. So that was our action. And we were trying to ask, what is the equation of motion that determines our main field? So we vary with respect to it. So now we have the analog. We have action or our metric variable, and then we have to vary with respect to it to obtain its evolution equation.
For the variation we do for the scalar field, you said you can draw the boundary term because we're working with Dirichlet conditions.
No, I didn't say Dirichlet conditions. You put those words, fine. You could use that. I said.
You said fix the boundary.
Right. I'm ignoring any change very far. If you think there are boundaries, there are some new terms. There is a correction to the action that we have to add. People in string, mainly people in string theory, would call the Gibbons-York boundary term. If you know what those are, no, the Gibbons-Hawking term, which was written several years before by York, but somehow, I mean, this happens again and again that people end up assigning the names not necessarily the first one that derived it, but you would have to, if we consider the influence of boundaries, that you're fixing the metric at the boundaries, the action is more complicated. But we're ignoring that. We're saying, okay, in any boundary contribution, we're going to assume that it's not there.
So in this particular case, we're fixing both the metric and the field at the boundary?
So, again, good question. It will depend on the nature of your boundary, where it's time-like, null, on space-like. You have to fix different pieces. So here we're assuming that the boundaries are sufficiently far and that the metric over there does have no change whatsoever. So we can, so this one will give us something, that is some contribution, but it's delta phi would be zero, so we can ignore it.
Thank
you. So if you want, there is a if you want to get all the details, there is a paper that was written a few years ago by Rob Myers, Eric Poisson, Raphael Sorkin, and myself, where we put all the potential boundary contributions. And you have the dictionary, but it's a lot of kind of algebra, or just fixing, oh, if you have this piece, this boundary with this characteristics, this is the piece you have to add. But it's not a big, I mean, it's nothing crucial. So we're ignoring any boundary here for the metric tensor, for the Hilbert action. Okay, so let's just go slowly. So we're going to vary. Let's say we're going to pick up, kind of, we want to pick up, just as we pick up an overall delta phi contribution, we're going to do the same thing with a delta g contribution. There's the second term, they say it's a trivial one. When we vary that one, okay, we just pick the delta here. When we vary this one, okay, we have to work a little bit, but this will be, remember, we use a few classes ago, I told you to derive the divergence of a vector by using, what was the name of that? Oh, I forget the name of, let me just look it up. Jacobi identity, so you can use Jacobi identities. And out of here, plus the observation that since this is true, if you take the variation of this one, you're going to get a zero, right? Which will give you a variation of delta GAB times GBC plus GAB delta GBC that has to be equal to zero. And out of this one, you can show that delta GAB is equal to minus GBC GAD.
Wait, sorry, why are we doing GABGBC? Like, why do we want the A and the C indices to be left over?
Good. And that's a great question. The reason I'm doing that is I'm going to tell you, let me show you the example, the step that goes from here, the next step that goes in between here and there.
Okay.
So first thing, I move this one to the right-hand side. I pick a minus sign. And that would be delta GAB. And I keep asking those questions, because this, I'm not so sure how much you guys are used to manipulating indices. So every time you need me, just tell me, and I'll try and get through. OK, so that's true. Maybe you were asking, why did I not put AB, AB here?
Yeah.
Good. If I had put AB, AB, I would have everything contracted.
Yeah.
And I would, what I'm trying to find is at the end of the day is something that has a clean variation with respect to indices down there, the metric.
Okay.
Because that comes when I vary the volume element. This is the determinant of the the covariant matrix, so indices down. If I expel this out, I'm going to pick up a 1 over square root of g, the minus g, then the variation of the determinant, and I keep going. And what I will be getting is something with respect to this.
Is there anything extra we have to consider when varying like a determinant? Is it weird?
Well, you use the Jacobi identity, and then it will pull up this.
Okay.
But you don't want that. You want this. So then we're trying to redo is relate this one with the variation of its covariant version, so when the index is upstairs. OK, then going back to your intuition, which I like why you asked that question, because had I put, if this were contracted, I'm stuck here. I cannot go forward. But once I'm here, I'm free to do the following. G, I want to get rid of this one here so that I end up with this one clean. So I can do it by hitting with GC, I don't know, P. Right? OK, now I look at GCP. This gives me delta PB. Right? Because this times that, now I'm contracting, this gives me the delta. I would not have been able to do this, because these indices would have been completely used up, contracted with this one. And once I have that, this tells me, look in what is left, find the B, and change it with the P. So then I do rid of that one. Then it's GAB, GCP, delta, BBC. Right? And so I have my result. So this, we're going to get back in a second here. But this one is sort of easy using this and the Jacobi identity. This one was trivial. This is the one that was going to give us nightmare. Because, I mean, this is a god-awful mess. OK, so how do we go? We could go first, write a definition of RAB, which will be RC. Well, let me just write it. Let me write it. Mu. So we can start from here. Compute this variation. We respect our metric and live with the consequences. Or we can try first to say, compute first. Variation with respect to the Christoffel symbols. So we're going to kind of hold on. We're going to do the variation of the Ricci's tensor with respect to the metric will be the variation of the Ricci's tensor with respect to the Christoffel. And in principle, we can then add the variation of the Christoffel with respect to the metric. The reason we're going to go in this direction is because we're going to be able to identify the contribution of that term is zero. And we can just do it at this level. So let's just go through a little bit of steps. So first thing first, we'll recall the definition of our Ricci Riemann tensor, which is d lambda minus the exchange of lambda and v, or mu. All right, so we start from here. This was our definition of the Riemann tensor. This, and then I'm not writing it down, but we have a term just like this, except that we flip lambda and mu. The
all lambdas are rows.
Which one, sorry? Roll? Oh, yeah, so. Here is some good. Then we're going to take the trace, because that's what we need over there. Can I erase this part? The next thing we're going to observe is that when we look at delta, gamma, and rho, nu, mu, so the variation in the Christoffel symbol, even though the Christoffel symbol is a symbol, the variation of the Christoffel symbol is a tensor. That sounds weird, but let's just kind of motivate how we know that. Remember, we had, suppose we have two metrics whatsoever, g and g prime. Associated to G, we'll have the covariant derivative D. Associated to G prime, we'll have the covariant derivative D prime. Suppose you have a vector V. And we could be computing this, or we could be computing that. Right, this is the covariant derivative associated with the metric G prime. This is the covariant derivative associated with the metric G. So out of this one, the definition would be dC, or definition how it acts. Right? Oops. And out of this one, it would be dC BA plus gamma prime CAB BB. Now, this is a bona fide tensor, right? It's a covariant derivative of the vector. It's another bona fide tensor. It's a covariant derivative of the vector. The difference between the two is a tensor.
Is the derivative the same?
Sorry again?
The
partial, yes, because it's, remember, out of G, we never said what G, that G was.
Oh, yeah.
We use corpus. So the first one is the same. The one that changes is the Christoffel symbol. But this one is a tensor, that's a set tensor. The difference of two tensors is another tensor. So this minus that is a tensor. But when I take the subtraction, this one cancels that one because they're the same. And this one will give me gamma AACB minus gamma prime ACB DB. And so if this is a tensor, that thing is a tensor. So the variation of the Christoffel symbol is a tensor, even though each one is not. But we're familiar with that every now and then. We did have things that make up tensors out of symbols. So this is where I give you, as an exercise, if you compute the variation of this one, it will be the variation that goes inside here, and so on. And you can, using that, you can prove that R nu lambda nu is gamma lambda to prove this. An exercise, and by the way, a message from Dalila. Tomorrow you have the tutorial next door, well, on the other side of the tracks, at CG. Have you been there? Yeah, okay. So tomorrow at 9, right? It's over there.
Is that R rho nu lambda nu? R,
the R. Oh, we did get
R. Oh.
Wait, I have a question, sorry. So the Christoffel symbol minus the Christoffel symbol.
Yes. It's something.
Is that the definition of our like variation of a Christoffel symbol? Is just one minus another?
Okay, so this one, in general, this is because it's, let me just say two things at once. You are letting me answer something and getting ahead of myself. In general, the difference between the Christoffel symbols associated with two metrics, which of course associate two covariant derivatives, will be a tensor. In the current context, we're assuming we have a metric G, this one, the metric G prime is that one. And we're using it in this context. We're allowing small variations of our metric to see which one extremizes the action. And this is what this is here. This is we're defining in this context as delta gamma ACB. And this is the one we're working with. But it need not be two small, nearby metrics. In general, the difference of two connections in the same manifold associated with two different metrics will give us a tensor. And this is a result that is, every now and then has to be used. OK, so then I'm just going back. We're trying to find out the variation of this, the contribution when we vary this one. I'm only working with that third variation. So we have En of x, square root of minus g, g mu nu, d delta r mu nu. Using that will be dn Let me write it explicitly. Okay, so now what we do is something that's very trivial, but it could be very easily get lost. So first thing first, these are covariant derivatives. We have a metric here. We're free to bring the metric inside. Now, any index that is repeated, we're summing. And because it's summing, it's called a dummy index. So we can give it any label we want. We're going to do that. So this goes into grad lambda g mu nu delta lambda nu mu, first term. Minus grad nu g mu nu delta gamma lambda lambda mu. Okay, so now let's play with indices.
You said that you use the relation with respect to the metric. You don't discard that and say that's zero.
No. These are the ones that will contribute.
We're delta g mu and the determinant of
this. No. Absolutely. We have three contributions. This one, that one, and that one.
Those two would give you, I think, Einstein's equation or something.
Yes, that would. Exactly, we'll give us Einstein's equation. In fact, we're going to see. So, yes, I mean, you're getting. Let me jump answering your question. When we vary delta g, right? That's delta g. That's the thing that we're varying. So this will leave us RAB. So the first term in Einstein tensor RAB is coming from there. The second, when we take a derivative of or a variation with this one, will give us a 1/2. So that's the one that will give us the Ricci scalar because that's what ends up here. So the variation of this term and that term give us an equation. We're trying to prove that this one is not going to give us anything. So what we do next here is then a relabeling of indices. So this new, so notice new is added over, lambda is added over. So we can change names. So change this one to lambda, because that's what we have over there. And we change this one to lambda. Because then we're going to change these ones to new. And what you'll have from there is grad lambda of something that is a bona fide tensor in here. Just fill in the details. But the point is, and this is related to the previous question, now we have the integral of dn square root of minus g of something that is a total derivative. And again, through the bound, through the assumption that very far nothing is contributing, this one we can ignore.
So I might get
yes.
Thing, might
no.
X and upstairs and also
dnx. Yes. Yes.
Why is there two lambdas in the second Christoffel symbol
there? Here?
Yeah.
Okay, so remember, we are flipping lambda and nu. So this comes from here. So every term that we worked with the first one, it's copied the second one, except that we flip the lambda and nu. And that's what we have this. And because we're seeing that one, so then I manipulate using the free index so that I end up having something is a bona fide tensor inside times the gradient or the covariant derivative of that, and then we can throw that away. So the only thing that we have left with is the variation with respect to the volume element or the determinant showing in the volume element, and that one will, which gives us precisely in the variation, that one implies and this has to be zero for any potential change in delta GAB, which then determines that this is our equation. Yes.
You said gradient lambda on the covariant derivative of the tensor.
Yeah.
That's zero because the thing inside.
Well, we have it's a tensor. It's actually a vector if you want. So it's S lambda. And because everything else is added. So it's something that has a free component lambda, and then through the divergence theorem, if you want, which we have yet to see, but it's a covariant derivative of something, and then we're throwing it away because we're imagining that far out, no changes are really happening. If we really were putting things into a boundary, then we have to add, if at the end of the day we want to recover this, we have to add counter terms at each boundary contribution.
You think that as lambda. Oh, so you're fixing the delta gammas?
So notice, let's see that one.
So you're saying S lambda in the boundaries goes to zero.
Let's say, that's right. That's yeah. And then the only free index, notice here, this is added. That's added. The only free index, or the only index that is, we ignore the covariant derivatives, this is lambda. So we have a vector that has component lambda here, that is, its divergence is being taken. So as a result, we have a contribution far out, an imaginary boundary where we have S lambda, we're imagining that there is no change. So this implies Einstein equation. If we're in vacuum, but now we have more, we could have a source.
Wait, sorry, I'm sure you don't have this in previous lectures.
No, go ahead.
How did we get from the previous line to the RAB minus?
Oh, okay. So no, I didn't give you. I mean, this is I said it in words from following a question by him. So let's start with the first one. Let's start with this one. How do we get this one? When we varied. We said we have a contribution here, a contribution here, and a contribution here.
Yeah.
We just argued that the contribution here is nothing. So it doesn't give us anything that contributes to the equation.
RAB?
Right, because what did we show? It gives us the divergence of a vector, and then using, say, the divergence theorem, we're saying that's evaluates to the value of that vector at some boundary, but we're saying at that boundary, the vector is not changing, so this is not contributing.
How do we know that it's not?
No, that's our assumption. So either, or if you want to think, I mean, the simplest way would be imagine that your manifold were periodic. So no boundary contribution would be there. The other one is to say, well, we have sources here, and this iteration takes place extremely far out. We're imagining we change the source slightly. And so it's not changing the metric in any significant way. So the boundary terms are not contributing. But in reality, if you want to do this very rigorously, and you want to arrive here, there are contributions that will come from those boundaries. So the way one fixes that to arrive here is to say the action is something in the volume of, right, plus extra contributions from all boundaries. So here is the n minus 1 x with suitable, say again?
Just the Ricci scalar.
The R is a Ricci scalar. The other ones, if you have a boundary, so you're saying, I want to recover Einstein's equations in this domain. Let's say, because you want to. But you want to say, inside of here, what I should get is Einstein's equation. So if I just stay with this thing, and I'm considering the boundaries, each of these pieces will give a contribution. So in reality, what one says is to say, well, that was an incomplete action. It just provided you the contribution of the bulk. We also need to add some contributions of each boundary piece. And if you define this in the right way, you can find that after you do the variation, you get exactly the equations, provided these pieces are the right ones. Remember how this came to be? And in some sense, you had the equations first, and then a posteriori you said, oh, there has to be an action principle that if I vary with respect to my field, my unknown, I get those equations. Mm-hmm. Right? So what I'm claiming is that if you have this is your domain, and you say, this is my action, I'm just telling you it's not enough. You need still some contributions from each of the boundaries such that when you do the variation, you end up with this.
Oh, so we didn't. So we didn't get that from varying this.
Okay, so hold on. Let's just backtrack a little bit. Suppose we do this following. So let's ignore boundary contributions for the time being. When we vary this, we find through that exercise that we have some boundary contribution. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to deal with that somehow. Let's put that aside. If we vary this piece, it gives us RAB, right? So if I vary that piece, that gives us delta GAB times RAB. Mm-hmm. So this is how we construct this piece, right? Now, if we vary that piece, the first thing we pick is 1 over square root of 2 because of this square root, the determinant in the denominator. And then we have the variation of the determinant, which itself will give us a square root of minus g in the numerator, which will simplify that thing, plus a piece that looks like the delta g that you asked me a question about. And then when you use that identity, you find that what you have is that piece.
Okay. For the boundary terms, we can just say, well, it's our assumption that it's 0 on the boundary. So we have
What we could say is that if our manifold has periodic boundaries, okay, there is no contributions of the boundary. Mm-hmm. If we are assuming that asymptotically nothing is changing, then that's 0. Mm-hmm. But in reality, if we really want to be as rigorous as we can, we say, well, there is a contribution of the boundaries, which will modify this thing. We'll say the equations that we get is this plus some boundary contribution, which then we're not obtaining Einstein equations. But we can fix that by saying, oh, we missed something in the action, which are contributions of the boundaries. And if we write them correctly, I don't want to say smartly because I just told you I have a paper with this. So correctly, then you can have them be exactly such that they cancel those contributions. And then you recover as equations, which is how you started. You started saying there has to be an action principle that when we work with it, we obtain these equations. So first, there was the equations, then there was the action.
Are there any other corrections we should consider to make it more correct?
No. With this, well, the only one, if you want to entertain what she was talking about, the cosmological constant. Notice that I have said nothing about the cosmological constant. That, if you want to do that, well, you do it here. So you introduce a lambda in here. And remember, this piece, the variation of that one, will give you something times delta GAB, which will then give a source that has the lambda. But we are not talking about the cosmological constant for a moment. Are we good?
This is a very stupid question.
No.
Why are we generating an action? What are we
going to use it for? OK, great. So first question. I mean, the first answer, there is an idea, at least, that in physics, any physical theory should be derivable from an action principle. At least to say, well, check, we can do that. Einstein equation or Einstein theory of relativity is not something that comes out of the blue sky. If you want, you can keep putting in the same framework where you believe that any physical theory that you have could be derived from an action principle. So that's pretty cool. The second one is we can very quickly make contact with this minimal coupling that we discussed with matter, because this, so far, we have discussed Einstein's equations without any source whatsoever. We don't know what's going to cause any curvature. So while we can accommodate gravitational waves in this, we can't accommodate in the presence of this chalk or us gravitating. So how do we do that? Then we have to come back, if you want, to here. If in that, there was, so you, we could have thrown in our space-time some scatter field that will help curve the space-time. And what we have to do is, when we vary with respect to the scatter field, we obtained the equation of motion of the scatter field. But when we haven't buried this one with respect to the metric. When we bury this one with respect to the metric, we're going to find the TAB that describes that scatter field. That is how it couples to Einstein's equation.
For example, if you use this for cosmological stuff like inflation, slow and stuff like that.
Good. If you say, well, I have some source for my spacetime that is has this physical constant, absolutely. You're going to say the action is this one. And then you go through, and then that's what you want. In fact, I mean, many theories for inflation is exactly that thing with the suitable potential. But that was a great question. OK, so let's go there. Oh, so let me just mention one more thing. Einstein's equation has a factor of 1/2. And the only reason I mention it is because that's something I wondered many years ago. That equation over there was for n arbitrary dimensions. So the 1/2 is a 1/2 regardless of the number of dimensions that we have. Okay. I don't know. You might find that a silly comment, but I wondered about that. Okay. So now suppose we couple with a source. Which is given by some itself, an action can be derived by an action principle. So there is some action principle associated with, and I'm going to put a subindex m for matter, but of course it doesn't have to be matter. Any source of any source that would show up in the right hand side of Einstein's equations, that's what we're saying. Our minimally coupled statement is to say that the full action is equal to S Hilbert plus SM. So if we have electromagnetic fields, we're going to have to put the Lagrangian or the Lagrangian density associated to the electromagnetic fields. If we have fluids, we have to put that and so on and so forth. To get the right A pi, we need to do this here. And have the Newton's constant there, 1 over 16 pi g. And do not get messed up with the volume element. We do that. So we're going to have a functional derivative. Well, let me put it this way. Or no, let me just do it this way. So first, this way. And we're going to define out of this, the following will come out. If we vary, so that the variation will provide this. And so we're going to identify this whole thing with T mu nu up to a factor of, let's say, out of this one, to identify. Right, so if you're trying to say what is the effective T mu nu that comes out of this, compute the variation with respect to G mu nu, divide by the determinant, and that would be your T mu nu. And here you see why we have to throw in the 1/16 pi g, and also why this thing has a 2 there.
Oh,
because again, we're after this equation.
Right. Okay.
So if we didn't have this one, we either put it here or we put it somewhere there, and you have to remember to carry the right 8 pi, or proportionality constant with respect to pi. So we might as well just put it here, and it's accounted for. So this will give you a TAB. And then the Einstein equations will be obtained from there.
Oh, and because we have like a root minus g out in front of the Einstein.
That's right.
That's why we have
right.
Okay. Yeah.
Then you simplify it with that.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
So why does the it's not giving the suppose r or?
Excellent. This is our principle. It has to be minimally coupled. That need not be the case. There are theories out there that is not minimally coupled, where then inside of S matter, you might have all the fields of that are associated with the matter. So in this case, I would put phi, for instance, but it will also might put the square root of the determinant of the metric, or something like that. And then that one then gives, now when you notice that when you vary that guy, then you're going to modify this term. Or you're going to pick up other terms in here that are more complex. So here, where you're saying the only thing that you allow in the minimal coupling is the one that shows up in the volume element. But if in addition you make the field or whatever unknowns in here, your matter fields, depend on the metric, then you pick up extra terms. And now you don't get Einstein equations, you get something else.
Also, there should be other equations as well, which I get by getting extended.
So here, this is what you're doing. Those are the equations of motion of the field itself. So the equations of motion of the field phi, kind of put in between parentheses, will be delta Sm divided with respect to phi. So how the matter action contribution varies with respect to the field itself, which is what we did over there.
But we do have TAB and 2G.
Yes, but notice there was the minimum. So it's just a volume element and any contraction. We don't have phi times that in any way here. So we just simply did the extension of the physics we knew in flat space-time. We covariantized it. We didn't do anything else.
Can it be proven that we cannot get additional equation with another kind of coupling rather than minimal coupling? Is it necessary to always have minimal coupling to get an additional equation?
Yeah, otherwise you're going to get something else.
We cannot define our original tensor somebody else and then define the action as not minimal coupling action.
But then you're.
There's a degeneracy in definition of action and T mu nu.
So yeah, but also you want to make contact of your T mu nu with what you know in flat space time. So. You're either messing the left-hand side or messing the right-hand side, but something is going to get not the simplest covariant way of taking your original theory in flat space-time and just making it covariant. I mean, I'm not 100% sure of that answer, but every case I've seen, even very simple modifications do change. Either they change, and they should, maybe this is, I'm getting way ahead of myself, but maybe you know about this. You either get, say, something that is more complicated in here, some other, and then the TAB is sane, And then you can show that a suitable transformation of your metric gives you back Einstein equations with a weirder source. And this, but then the equations of motion of your source are affected. And the, again, the case that I know of will have, for instance, the right-hand side of this equation of motion coupled with the metric in a non-trivial way, and then you have phenomenology. So it violates the principle, the strong equivalence principle. But this is, again, I'm happy to go on and on about this, but we're not discussing this at the moment.
Also, you could just when
minimal couple, so far, always. So we haven't done, we haven't gotten any a single evidence of it failing. Of course, at some point, and again, it depends on your taste because of what we were actually chatting or chit-chatting right when class was about to start. If you want to say that the presence of dark matter or the observations of dark matter or dark energy are already telling you that Einstein's equations fail, then you already have plenty of answers to say, oh, we need to do something else. If, on the other hand, you're saying, no, there is some source of energy that we still have to understand, then I would stand by what I said. There, we still don't have any evidence for the minimal coupling principle, if you want, to be failing. But there is a subset of researchers that said, no, already dark energy and dark matter are plenty of reasons to say that it already failed.
Is there a way to derive the energy content answer from a sort of matrix theorem?
Yes, you can, and that they are slightly different. We can go. Let me not go into this right now. They are related, and one is called the canonical stress energy tensor as opposed to this one. But the one that shows up in kind of the easy derivation of Einstein's equations and the principle we're getting is this one, not that other one. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You have to be careful. I'll get. Remind me to eventually one day we discuss this.
We know that Schwarzschild metric is the solution of Bacon's 10 minutes zero so energy stress tensor.
That's right.
Energy should be zero if integrated on this tensor.
Okay, so I was with you all the way till you said energy should be zero. But to be careful, we can hide energy in curvature. So there is plenty of curvature in the Schwarzschild solution. If you're an asymptotic observer and you're just feeling the gravitational pull, if you want, of some object, something, some source distribution, you will say, oh, there is something there that is pulling me. And where it's an object that you can feel and sense, that is, you would say, oh, this is the object that is exerting a force on me. Or where is it simply the curvature of space-time? That would be your choice if you want to interpret one way or another. But Schwarzschild solution, yes, has no source, but has plenty of curvature. And that curvature is the source of whatever, every dynamical thing that you can think of. And if you asymptotically say, is this object moving, say, around the central object in a particular way? Yes. Is it consistent with this object having this amount of mass? Yes. And fine.
Then how can you compute the total energy of given space?
You do it rigorously. Okay, we're going to go there. In the case of Schwarzschild, it's not difficult because we have plenty of symmetries. In particular, we have a time-like healing field. Again, we're going to define what this is. This defines for us a set of special observers, and we can ask those observers what they measure, and they will associate to them, there will be an energy, and then associated to them will be a mass. Also, if you go asymptotically far, you can ask what is the gravitational strength of the field, and again, it's proportional to a mass, and that's the mass of the spacetime. In a general spacetime, we don't know how to do this, except that asymptotically, we can compute some quantities, which would be the global mass of the spacetime, but we don't know what's going on inside. Again, we cannot, in that situation, we cannot define what's the mass of this. There was a question here.
My question is related, but like, since you've already answered this, you said that there is no matter in the Schwarzschild solution, but there is curvature. That's not like, trivial, just without having matter, the space time is. There was a star initially, I think, but.
We can make a Schwarzschild black hole or black hole with gravitational waves. So we could have prepared the initial state such that so once we look at the equations in details, we could have prepared our initial state that there is sufficient amount of gravitational energy coming in through gravitational waves, that as they come in, they curve the space-time enough that form a black hole. So we don't need a star, but I mean, you were going, you could, we could have a star. We could have had a star that was, that's the question is, how did we dynamically form this object? Which is, I would argue, is the relevant question. Whether we have a solution that satisfies a whole bunch of things and we cannot prove how it formed dynamically and what its stability properties are, might be just doing kinematics, right? So for that point of view, when we discuss Schwarzschild equations, if you want, that would be kinematics. Then we're going to be able to connect it with dynamics. And indeed, if you have a general kind of spherically symmetric distribution that collapses on its own and forms a black hole will be that of Schwarzschild because there would be theorems that back this up. But from the point the black hole onwards form, okay, the solution is there, it's time independent, and there will be all these nice properties that we'll discuss.
Can you explain how you got yourself to the second line again? I didn't quite
understand that. So if you want, just, I mean, this is the definition, but you could do that exercise. Take that action that you had there, vary with respect to the metric, and say, is this T mu? You're going to see that it's proportional to T mu by this. And then I would need these factors, 16 pi g, and this minus 2, just to make sure that I end up with the GAB that I wanted, and the TAB.
So by delta is something like delta G, you don't mean that you're dividing those two.
No, it's a variation, if you want to, this is just a notation. It's a variation of S with respect to G. Remember what we said, if we vary with respect to the field, it
is actually a division because you don't have.
Yeah, but it's a functional derivative. That's why it's denoted by this delta. Once we are starting, what is the equation of motions for a metric field? We're varying with respect to the metric field. And once we're studying what is the variation, the equation of motion for the fields that are providing the source, we're varying with respect to those fields. Any other question?
Yeah. So
that's okay.
Why are we varying the, that was the matter action, right? The SM?
Yes.
Source. So why are we varying it with respect to the metric? Why are we varying it with respect to the field? I don't know.
Good. So there. So we, let's say our full problem in that case, we have a manifold with a metric and some sources that affect what that metric is. So we need to have a full description for that. So we need to have an equation of motion that will determine what these guys are, an equation of motion that determines what that guy, those guys are. So we claim that all the physics, if we follow that philosophy, that all the physics that we can think of should be derived by an action. And then the question is, can we do that? Yes, if we write it this way, and we vary with respect to this field, we get the equation of motion for that field. If we vary with respect to the matter field, we get the equation of motion for that field. So in this case, we would have, in that case, then what we would have is, right, is this one. GAB equal A pi GAB for a scalar field, and then box pi equal to zero in the absence of a potential. So before we wrap, let me just say one more thing. We briefly mentioned this at the end of yesterday's lecture. At this point, maybe you should be saying, OK, we cheated. What we do here, there is something. We kept saying the Riemann tensor is the tensor that that describes our curve manifold. But we're finding an equation of motion that tells us something about the Ricci tensor. What happens with the rest? Are we free to give them, remember, the Riemann tensor? OK, let me just give you the explicit expression. So out of the, let me just call it this way. After the Riemann tensor, we constructed R, RAB. But there are many more components here than the ones that we could be fixing by saying something about RAB, right? And we describe another tensor. Which contain those trace-free parts. So what happened with those guys? I mean, are we allowed to give whatever? Are we uniquely specifying the Riemann tensor? When once we solve Einstein's equations, are we uniquely specifying this guy, or are we only just saying something about this? Something that we have yet to use or to remember is Bianchi identity, which told us in particular that grad lambda or rho sigma mu nu is equal to 0. I remember what this was the trace-free parts of the Riemann. And we can write this guy in the following way. So remember, we had introduced a definition for C. So if you want, you can start with R and start computing traces and trace-free parts. And out of that, you can then have this identity, which told us what we knew, that the Riemann tensor can be written in terms of the trace parts. This is the fully traced, partial traces, and the trace-free parts. You can then say, well, use this identity. I mean, this is a bit cumbersome, but you can prove it. Use this identity. And what you can show is the following, that the following is true.
So
yes.
You already say that this is, so the C, is that just a definition here? Or
you could take it as a definition, or you could remember that we said, okay, take the R and compute many traces and the trace-free parts. And then out of that, then you can then write, if you want, just put this one here and that one over there. And it will be how you write a Riemann tensor in terms of the Biot tensor, the Ricci scalar, and the Ricci tensor.
Oh, we did just have the Biot tensor. Okay.
And the only reason we're writing this way is that then you can show, because this is because of the way we discussed. We said the Riemann tensor, the information is in the Ricci tensor, and the Biot tensor. Mm-hmm. We have written an equation of motion that links these guys to sources. What happened with that guy? Who is telling us how this should behave? And then through Bianchi identities, we find that there is a relation between, say, well, OK, gradients of that C and R's and the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar. But we have already seen or established Einstein's equation, there is a relation between R's and the T's. So one can use the definition or Einstein's equations and replace the R's here by T's.
So how did we get the definition of the
Biot
tensor?
We defined it. We said, out of the Riemann tensor, let's define some special tensor. So we define the very the most special tensor, which is was a scalar, which is the Ricci scalar.
And this one's just the trace-free part.
And this one were the pure trace-free parts of the Riemann tensor.
Okay.
So any trace that you take here will give you zero.
Okay.
Now, the question is that I was trying to get to is we had an equation of motion that determines these guys in terms of sources. What is going to define what these guys are? Because if these guys can be completely free, we're not being able to fully specify or fully determine what the Riemann tensor should be if we give sources or if we establish the problem we're working on.
I'm sorry, but that equation is an equation for the metric components. And if we have the metric components up to second derivatives.
Yeah, you could do that. Right, but there is a lot of components here. You may wonder, what I'm trying to say is motivated out of here, you actually are saying things with respect to these arc components as well. And so what I'm saying is that Bianchi identities, that of course have to be satisfied there, that object satisfies the Bianchi identity. Bianchi identities are also showing that there is a relation of the gradient or the derivative operator on C linking with R, but if it links with R, it links with T. So there is a way to say this implies there is some grads of the C's with some source given by T's, or maybe grads of T's. Out of here, it would be grads of T's. So up to some constant, initial constant of motion, because here is with respect to the gradient, we have also a way to link the C's with the T's. But it's related to his question. I mean, hidden in that, because the Einstein tensor satisfied the Bianchi identities, this was there.
I didn't quite understand. How do you replace the Ricci tensor with T?
Because because we have Einstein equations. Einstein equations are telling us that RABs, that Ricci scalar is associated with its trace of the transitive tensor, and the Ricci tensor is associated with the transitive tensor. So in the Einstein equations, we also have an equation for the C.
But this means that. If we know the stress-energy tensor and we know its derivative, we already calculated that. That means we can calculate the full curvature algebraically.
Yes. Yeah. You could do that. And this was related to his question. If I knew the full G, I could come and obtain this full Riemann, and out of it we'll get it. So it's just a motivation to say, even if you kind of for a moment ponder, okay, what happens if we're only just fixing some piece of the Riemann tensor? How do we get the other ones?
No, T. I don't need to calculate G. I'm just saying, fixing T, like, I'm going to get...
Oh, you can't fix T.
Huh?
You can't fix T.
The source, the energy, I can't?
No, because the T also knows about G. This is the problem with a problem and feature of Einstein's equations that in here, G shows there, but it also shows there.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, no, but good point. So we're going to stop here. What I'm going to do, the last thing I'm going to do in this week is to say, well, we have built all this infrastructure. We're going to go get some solutions out of here. But prior to do that, I'll give you one showing of how you can get a lot of information without even solving the problem, just by looking at geometrical properties of the problem of interest. And we're going to link halfway through, then eventually we'll complete it, with the singularity theorem, something that will tell us if you have this, you're either going to have a singularity in the future, and then we're going to have to pray that the black hole kind of hides problematic regions away, or if we go to the past, we make contact with the Big Bang. So we're going to do the very first contact with that without solving a single equation. Well, actually, we solve one of the equations. But that we'll do in the next class. Thank you.